Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 3rd, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got the usual pair of interviews lined up tonight. First, in about 8 minutes or so, we'll speak with Tamara Drought, who is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at the Demos Think Tank here in New York City, talking about debt. People in their 20s are up to their ears in debt. Retirees are up to their ears in debt, and why Americans have been borrowing so much. And then at the bottom of the hour, a not unrelated topic, we'll speak interview recorded earlier this week with Steve Fraser, who is the author of a new book called Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. It's not so much an economic look at Wall Street, but a political and cultural look at the role of this street that I'm sitting on right now, although certainly we're not in tune with the major activity of this street, but the role of Wall Street in the politics and culture of this country from the beginning to what seems like the day before yesterday. So that will be in about half an hour. First, before we get to the interviews, a couple of some news headlines. First of all, the usual weekly tally of jobless claims, that is the number of people who lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that was down 1,000 last week, 310,000. And last several weeks it's been quite low. It's taken quite a dramatic drop from the high 300,000s last summer now into the low 300,000s. And we're now at the lowest levels for this indicator since before the recession began. I think you have to go back to the middle of 2000 before you get to these kinds of levels. So that side of the labor market at least improving, that is, fewer people losing their jobs. Whether on the other side people are actually being hired is not quite clear yet. And we will find out tomorrow morning how many people, how many jobs were gained in the month of February when the Labor Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its monthly employment report, and we'll get a whole raft of numbers. A lot of people, people on Wall Street, expecting a pretty big positive number, a gain of as many as 300,000 jobs, some expectations. Over the long term, the rough gain in a month would be about 220,000, so 300,000 may sound like a lot, but it's not all that much above average. A lot of people expecting considerably less than that, 200,000 or less, so we will see. It's been very, very difficult to predict the employment numbers in the last couple of years because all the old models that used to work aren't working anymore. They're projecting that we should have seen much more rapid job growth than we have actually seen, and it does seem that at least up until now, employers have been very, very reluctant to hire people. They prefer to work their existing labor forces harder, lay people off, outsource, whatever, speed up anything but hiring. And a lot of people expecting that they may finally break that habit and start hiring perhaps as soon as the employment report that's released tomorrow, we shall see. We also saw last year a couple of months in which there was very strong employment growth, but then it would fall back to very weak numbers. So really no strong uptrend in employment yet. This is very unusual for this stage of a business cycle. The recession ended more than 3 years ago, and we are somewhere around 10 million jobs below where we would be if this were a normal recovery expansion period of the economy, but we're not there. We've got a major deficiency. And lots of people have also dropped out of the labor force. The unemployment rate at 5.2% is actually slightly below its long-term historical average, but because so many people have dropped out of the labor force and are therefore not counted as unemployed, that number is actually artificially low. It would probably be, if all those people were still in the labor force and counted as unemployed, which is probably what they really are, then the unemployment rate would be over 7%. But that's not how it's defined. You have to be actively looking for work to be counted as unemployed. If you've given it up as hopeless, you're counted as not in the labor force, according to the official calculations. The weekly tally of consumer attitudes from the ABC News Washington Post survey, that gained a couple of points last week to -9, which is roughly in line with its long-term average, but still a pretty weak number. Consumer attitudes not so hot, even though supposedly the economy is in pretty decent shape. Most ordinary people are not feeling it that way. An especially large gap persists in this survey between Democrats and Republicans, with Republicans feeling an awful lot more optimistic than Democrats. And it's not just a function of the normal things like race and income, which contribute to partisan affiliation. It's also a purely partisan effect. Interesting. The gap between in attitudes between rich and poor, which is normally fairly wide, is not out of the ordinary, but the gap between Democrat and Republican is very, very wide by historical standards. Two surveys from the Institute for Supply Management. This is people who buy things for large corporations and presumably are in good touch with the state of the business, and these are surveys with a long history and a wide following among Wall Street and other analysts. The manufacturing index off in the month of February, still positive, but decline, and it's been slowing since it peaked out a little over a year, about a year ago. So still positive, but the manufacturing sector is slowing down, and the employment component of that index also dropping off. So factory employment performing very poorly in this recovery expansion period. And the ISM survey, the Institute for Supply Management survey of service companies, which is a much newer thing, only about 15 years old, as opposed to the manufacturing survey, which is about 40, 50 years old. That number, very strong this morning, released this morning, 59.8. Any number above 50 is indicates an expanding economy. This is well above 50, one of the higher readings in the history of this index. And its employment component, very, very strong. It's been actually been stronger than actual employment has turned out to be in the last year or so. So we'll see if this is giving a false alarm. But that is some encouraging news for the job market. Bankruptcy filings, it was reported earlier this week, down for the fifth consecutive quarter. This is not unusual behavior for a recovery expansion period in the economy. Bankruptcy filings generally fall as the economy does better and rise as the economy does badly. But they're still, despite this decline, still very, very, very high, among the highest in the history of this series, going which goes pretty far back. So bankruptcy looking a little better, but because people are so up to their ears in debt, the numbers are still quite high. And we'll hear more about that in a couple of minutes. And then also the Business Roundtable, a business-sponsored group, surveyed a bunch of CEOs and found them feeling rather optimistic about the state of the economy, the state of their companies. And, of course, they didn't ask, but I'm sure they're very optimistic about the states of their paychecks, which are very, very fat. But the interesting thing in this index is, though, that even though that the CEOs are expecting increase in sales and they're expecting to increase their spending on plant and equipment in the coming 6 months, fewer of them are expecting to hire new employees. So we still have this interesting and persistent disconnect between the state of the economy, capital E, and what's actually happening to people in the job market. So the number, again, the employment number positive, but down from late last year, and not a big positive number. So we shouldn't be seeing that if these CEOs are optimistic, but they prefer to work people harder rather than to hire new ones. So let's take a little musical break and come back with Tamara Drought. And that a little bit from Brahms' first piano sonata, performed by Svyatoslav Richter. We'll be hearing further excerpts from that later in the show. And I forgot to mention in the headlines at the top that oil prices are up over 50 cents today on the futures exchange just down the street to over $53, a pretty high number. You know, if we got back to the late 1970s, early 1980s high, it would be about $100 now. But still, this is very, very considerably higher than what we saw throughout the 80s and 90s. So this is going to be, if it stays up here, it could be a considerable drag on economic activity going forward. So we'll see what comes of that. But the Saudis said earlier in the week that they foresee oil prices staying pretty high in the $40 to $50 range, which is a considerably more hostile tone coming from them than we'd heard in the recent past. So now we're joined on the line by Tamara Drought, who is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at the Demos think tank here in New York City and co-author of several papers of theirs, among them Generation Broke, The Growth of Debt Among Young Americans, Retiring in the Red, The Growth of Debt Among Older Americans, and Borrowing to Make Ends Meet, The Growth of Credit Card Debt in the 1990s. So let's talk about debt. Welcome to WBAI, Tamara Drought.
Hi, good to be here.
So let's start with the young folks.
All right.
I was reading some Social Security polls earlier in the week and discovered that, well, it's hardly a new discovery, but younger people are among the most enthusiastic supporters, not that there are all that many around, but the strongest support for the idea of Social Security privatization or private accounts comes from younger people in their 20s and early 30s. But these people aren't exactly thriving financially, are they?
No, they're not. But a note about the polls. One thing that the polls do reveal is that when young people are told more about what privatizing Social Security would mean in terms of it would definitely mean a cut to guaranteed benefits, their support for privatization drops significantly. And in fact, they're not willing to trade cuts in guaranteed benefits for private accounts. You know, I think their support for Social Security reform really stems from the fact that they don't think it's going to be around from them, and they are living very economically insecure lives right now thanks to growing amounts of debt, including credit card debt and student loans, which are now in the five figures.
Yeah, let's talk about, first of all, the student loan business.
Yep.
What does a typical person graduate from college with?
Today they're graduating with, on average, about $19,000 in student loan debt, and that's an average. So if you go to a private school, it's going to be much higher.
And how does that compare to the past? Has it been growing?
It's doubled since about 1993. And if you look at back in the 1980s, the problem of student loan debt wasn't even on the national radar screen. In fact, the only professions that really required going into debt were the medical and legal professions. But today...
Yeah, you know, I had a friend who went to business school in the 80s and paid off all his loans with his first bonus, but I guess most graduates are not able to do that.
No, they're not. And it's very rare that, particularly students that go on to get master's, that the amount that they leave in debt will be more than the starting salary of their job.
And my impression was that people in college are also working more than they used to. So why do they graduate with all this debt?
That's a great question, and indeed they are working more than ever before while they're in school. The problem is really the way we allocate financial aid, and the fact of the matter is that at the federal level, they've just completely dropped the ball. Grant aid has dwindled. The amount of loans that students can get, the low-cost government-guaranteed loans has not increased, so increasingly students can't even get their hands on enough loans to get to college. And finally, at the state level, you know, back in the flush times of the late 1990s, states really had a lot of extra money. And instead of putting it in a rainy day fund, they gave lots of people tax breaks. And now, as they struggle to balance their budgets, one of the first things they're cutting is their support for higher education. And as a result, state colleges are increasing their tuition.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that someone going to a private college has a larger debt burden on graduation, but public college tuitions are getting considerably high, aren't they?
They are indeed. I mean, the average cost of going to college, and that includes tuition as well as room and board, is now about $12,000 at the average public university.
So So it's easy to see how people could rack up $20,000 in debt. It's amazing they don't rack up more.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to see the trends continue to go up because the tuitions have shown no signs of stabilizing at this point.
And then what about credit card debt? That's certainly just about everybody walking the face of the planet now is running
that's
a credit
true.
Card debt. But what about people in their 20s?
Well, people in their 20s are in about the same amount of as credit card debt as, you know, average households. But they're more likely to be in debt. And I think one of the main reasons is there's just a lot of startup costs associated with becoming an adult. You know, you need to put a down payment on an apartment. I've talked to so many young people that are using credit cards to pay for their down payments on apartments, especially in big cities. And then you have to build your life. You have to get a car. Car repairs are a major reason why young people report credit card debt. And then there are just things like getting a professional wardrobe, trips to visit friends and families. This is a big one for college grads who tend to move away from their homes and need to take an airplane to visit their families. There's just a lot of pressures right now on young people as they try and make the transition, you know, from student to worker.
And I'm looking at some of the key findings in the report, Generation Broke, which is available on the Demos website, demos-usa.org. The average credit card debt, the average young household with credit card debt spends nearly 24% of its income on debt payments.
Right.
And one in five spend over 40% of their income servicing debt, including mortgages and student loans. 40% is an astonishing number.
It is, and even the 24% is astonishing because, you know, among young people in the 25 to 34-year-old age group, about half of them don't have mortgages. So already they're paying about 25 cents out of every dollar on debt payments, and in all likelihood, they haven't even added a mortgage to their debt obligations. So we're looking at a pretty intense debt burden among this generation that is largely being driven by student loan debt, but also the same reasons why so many other Americans are in credit card debt. You know, the fact is that wages are not keeping up with cost of things like housing and health care.
Yeah, and I was speaking with Tamara Drought, who is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at the Demos think tank here in New York City and co-author of several of their papers on indebtedness and living standards and such. And turning to the other end of the age spectrum, I was certainly aware of the problem of people in their 20s, but I was somewhat surprised to read in your report, Retiring in the Red, that older Americans, even retirees, are exhibiting credit card problems. What's happening there?
Well, I think, again, rising health care costs, that's a big reason we hear from older Americans about why they're in credit card debt. Many are using credit cards to pay for, you know, very expensive prescription drugs. And another thing is just declining retirement security. You know, the truth of the matter is we're talking about reforming the only guaranteed security that older Americans have in this country, because, you know, the reality is half of all workers don't have a private pension benefit, and they really rely on the benefits from the Social Security system.
Yeah, the myth is that older people have lots of savings that they can draw on, but in fact, those who do, in most cases, pretty small savings, and for an awful lot of people, Social Security is their principal and, in some cases, only source of income.
Exactly. And what we as a nation really need to be focusing on is, one, you know, making sure that the system stays solvent, and there are some much easier fixes to accomplish that than privatization. And two, really looking at helping people better save for retirement so that they're not relying on Social Security as much as they currently do. We need to really beef up savings among current workers, young people included, and the reality is that most of the benefits that accrue to people who are saving accrue high up on the income ladder. They rarely reach young people, and they rarely reach people who are in the middle of the income distribution and below.
Well, and part of the problem is that people outside of the top portion of the income distribution just don't have a lot of spare change to save.
Absolutely.
And I was amazed to read a stat from Ed Wolf, one of his reports for the Levy Institute a while back, that the average person with savings outside the top 20% of the income distribution has only enough money to live for a month or two. It's really, most people don't have much in the way of savings.
Absolutely, and that's to live in a month or two at the poverty level.
Yeah, which is...
which, you know, most families probably can't drop down to at a month's notice.
No, certainly not. Well, I'm also amazed looking at this Retiring in the Red report, again, that... One in five families with a credit card among seniors has a debt hardship, paying over 40% of their income in debt payments. What you call transitioners, people who are near retirement, 55 to 64, 31% of income on debt payments. How do people get by paying that, you know, a third of their income servicing debt?
Well, they go into more debt. That's the problem, is that once you're in debt, it becomes another payment obligation, and that further straps you each month, and that leads to more debt. And the problem that we face right now is what's happening to young people with the pressures to try and come up with money to go to college, because we all know that to get into to the middle class today means you have to go to college and get a bachelor's degree. It's impacting the parents of these kids who are trying to save for retirement but are now diverting a lot of their savings into paying for retirement. And they're also taking out additional mortgages on their home, which means we're going to see an increasing trend where seniors are still paying off their mortgages well into retirement, which is something new.
And these reports you did rely for their raw data on the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances, which is certainly the best piece of evidence that we have. But the most recent survey is from 2001. The 2004 one is not out yet. So I imagine we're going to see some worsening debt pictures, especially given the way that people have been borrowing home equity.
Absolutely.
This is not in any of the reports, but do you have any thoughts about what's going on with these incredible tapping of home equity credit?
Well, actually, we do have a new report out about that very thing, and the numbers are astonishing. You know, homeowners took out about $450 billion in equity during this refinancing boom, and most of them did so in order to pay off other debts or to maintain current consumption.
Yeah, let's talk about the reasons for borrowing. I mean, there's a kind of Calvinist moral discourse that people are just indulgent they're, you know, buying luxuries and taking elaborate vacations. Is that really the reason that people have been using the credit cards and the mortgage debt so heavily?
No, and I think that, you know, this myth that we've become much more materialistic in the last decade is really just a tool to keep people from looking at the larger economic issues in this country and the national priorities and changes in public policy that have gotten us to this state of widespread financial insecurity. It's easy to blame people for their financial problems, but the reality is so much of credit card debt is mundane visits to the doctor, car repairs, things like braces for their kids, school clothes for their kids. It's a far cry from sort of the plasma televisions and game boxes that we tend to think about.
And the growth in credit card debt among low-income and even very low-income people has been quite astonishing, hasn't it?
It has been astonishing. In fact, among lower-income people, those who earn less than $25,000 has been one of the fastest-growing groups. If you've ever lived on a low income, one thing you know for sure is you know how to be financially resourceful. So when we see that even low income households are now turning to credit cards on a pretty regular basis, it's a sure sign that this economy is really not benefiting the majority of Americans.
And a lot of people think, well, you know, I don't have a credit card problem. I make my minimum every month.
Right.
What about that minimum?
Well, that minimum will not get you out of debt. There's, especially with some of the interest rates that are all too common today, you know, 29% is pretty standard in this market if you've made a late payment at any time. If you pay the minimum on your balance, you're basically just paying interest, and you're looking at, you know, four decades of payments in order to pay down that balance.
Yeah, you're not exaggerating, right?
No, I'm not exaggerating.
If you have like
and that's 5, for a pretty low balance.
If you have $5,000 and pay the minimum, you could take 30 or 40 years to pay it off.
Right? Absolutely. And you know, that's a pretty low balance as things go today.
And what about bankruptcy? They're talking about tightening up the bankruptcy code in Congress. It's failed
yep.
a couple of times, but maybe it may have come back from the dead again.
Yes.
What's
it's
happening
back
with
from
that?
The dead. It's being debated right now in the Senate. They're at the point where they're now offering up amendments. Some Democrats are offering amendments to try and beef up some consumer protections because right now this bill is just completely lopsided. It's a bill written by the credit card industry and a bill that completely looks out for the credit card industry and does little to bring back some responsible lending among an industry that is just running amok right now and miring people in debt. And this time it looks like it's probably going to pass the Senate and then it will pass the House, and the president has shown his intention to sign it. So we're looking at even further tougher times for people who find themselves in financial collapse.
And as I usually do, I spend 90% of the time discussing the problem and 10% what to be done about it. But we have 2 minutes left. What is to be done about this?
I say we got to look at the federal financial aid system. The debt for diploma system is just atrocious, and it's really crimping young people's ability to get ahead in life. The second thing is we've got to do something that boosts the savings, the potential for people to save. So we got to look at income growth. But we also need to provide incentives to save, particularly down the generational and income ladder.
Well, what do you mean by incentives to save? The problem is people don't have the money, do they?
Well, it's a lot easier to cough up a dollar if you know you're going to get two matched by the federal government if you're in a certain income bracket, which is essentially what we do for people. Wealthy individuals who are saving in things like Roth IRAs and other retirement vehicles.
All right, so tell us about the Demos Institute. Who are you and what are you up to?
The Demos is here in New York City. We're a national organization. We've been really involved in the bankruptcy legislation that's going on right now, trying to bring some take out some of the lopsided nature of it and give some consumer protections. We're looking at the debt issue. Our other major programs look at how our democracy is doing and breaking down some of the barriers to voting, some of the election problems that we've been having in the last couple presidential elections.
All right, well, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Tamara Drought, who is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at Demos, which is a think tank based here in New York City. You can learn about them and download a lot of these papers we've been talking about at Demos, DEMOS-USA.org, DEMOS-USA.org. And I should say, before we take a little break, that talked a little bit with Tamara Drought about bankruptcy, talked with Elizabeth Warren at great length last week about bankruptcy, and I almost never give personal financial advice, but here's one bit of advice I will give. If you have a debt problem, a credit card debt problem in particular, other kinds are more complicated, but if you have a credit card debt problem, please consider filing for bankruptcy. The consequences are much less severe than you might imagine, and the pain involved is much less than the pain of straining to service the debt week after week and month after month, and you make those annoying calls from collection agents go away, and you can start with a clean slate. And if the Republicans get their way, and some Democrats as well, and the credit card industry, who's been financing this effort to rewrite the bankruptcy laws, if they all get their way, it's going to be a lot tougher. So if you've got a debt problem, consult with a lawyer. I can't give legal advice. Everyone's situation is different, but it's really worth looking into. So let's take a break, and I'll be back in a bit.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi.
Hi-Fi. WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
And we're back here, Behind the News, the show. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's take another listen to a bit of Brahms' First Piano Sonata played by Svatoslav Richter, and then we'll be back with Steve Fraser. Love that Soviet artist meeting the high points of Western culture. Svatoslav Richter, piano playing Brahms' First Piano Sonata, First Movement. And now, an interview recorded earlier in the week with Stephen Fraser, who is the author of the book Every Man a Speculator, a cultural and political history of Wall Street's role in American life. Not so much an economic look, but a culture and political look. Just out from HarperCollins. Lots of good stuff in this book, very large, but if you have an appetite for close to 700-page book, want to learn all about Wall Street, that's the place to go. So, Steve Fraser. Let's go back to almost the beginning. There was a conflict between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson that in many ways really laid out the polarities of political conflict that would characterize the rest of American history. So tell us about the struggle between Jefferson and Hamilton over Wall Street and its role in the young America.
Yeah, I think your take is exactly right. Wall Street is implicated in the sort of primordial struggles over the fate of the American Revolution. Hamilton, of course, is very interested in promoting a kind of moneyed elite that he feels is necessary to build the strength of the new nation's economy. He promotes, as a result, the national debt as a way of mobilizing the liquid capital of the country, hopefully as a way of promoting trade and manufacturing and so on. The Jeffersonians, on the other hand, are enormously worried about the development of a kind of what they call moneyed aristocracy, and that such an aristocracy, created in fact by the government through the instrumentality of the government debt, will undermine the accomplishments of the Democratic Revolution. And they are drawing from the lessons of Europe in making this prognostication. They worry very much that a government that can gather around it a kind of retinue of moneyed retainers will quickly restore the monarchy. And obviously Hamilton has monarchist sympathies, aristocratic sympathies. He is one of the architects of the Constitution, but had he had his way, there would have been a lifetime Senate, a lifetime presidency, and so on. Anyway, they engage in enormous battles all through the 1790s. Over a speculation and the debt. Hamilton sees speculation as a way of promoting economic growth and development. The Jeffersonians, Madison, and others see it as a kind of parasitism, as a kind of a way of leeching off the real wealth being produced by the agricultural economy and other aspects of the productive economy. Hamilton accuses the Jeffersonians of being Jacobins, of wanting to sort of being levelers, of wanting to abolish hierarchy, and Jefferson accuses the Hamiltonians of being Tories.
In staking out this position, Jefferson conveniently forgot about the slave relation that dominated the Southern economy, and also its embeddedness in international finance and trade. The cotton trade was very important, so it wasn't exactly the self-sufficient yeomanry of his fantasy.
No, you're absolutely right, and of course Jefferson himself is neck-deep in debt. And the economy that he promotes when he becomes president in 1800 is a deeply commercialized economy. Not only is he himself rooted in the slave economy, which is, of course, tied to the currents of international trade, but everything he does as president, or if not everything, some of the major things he does as president, work to promote the commercialization of the American economy and, therefore, the undermining of this yeoman self-sufficient agrarian economy, which is becoming increasingly, as the 19th century progresses, more myth than reality.
In material terms, Hamilton pretty much won that fight. The America that he wanted pretty much came to pass. But the Jeffersonian legacy really lingered on ideologically throughout the 19th century and is at the core of populism. So tell us about populism and its relation to Wall Street.
Yeah, I think that the populists, and even before them, those who found in Andrew Jackson a kind of populist hero warring against the monster bank, they carry on a kind of Jeffersonian rhetoric and political tradition which worries very much about the corruption of the political process by moneyed men. The populace are deeply worried about this. They see the great industrial and particularly financial institutions of the late 19th century, and particularly those centered in Wall Street, as increasingly suborning government officials, corrupting the institutions of democratic government, and making it almost impossible. And populists are commercial farmers. They're not yeomen either. They want to engage in a kind of commercial agrarian economy, but the enormous control over the flow of credit and the control over the great railroad trunk lines upon which all agrarians depend to have their commodities marketed, and the control exercised by the great commodity speculators enormously worries them about their own ability to survive as commercial farmers. And because this finance, railroad interest is controlling the Senate, the House of Representatives, the Supreme Court, is corrupting the churches, is controlling the press, they feel increasingly that they represent a threat to democratic, Jeffersonian, democratic popular rule.
Now, unfortunately, a lot of that populism or Jackson was rather racist, and a lot of the populist critique or broader critique of Wall Street throughout the 19th century in particular was laced with anti-Semitism. What about that?
I would say two things about that. First of all, anti-Semitism runs throughout a lot of populist rhetoric, cartooning, and so on. However, the populists have often been criticized as kind of antediluvian, backward-looking, provincial anti-Semites. While the anti-Semitism is true, it doesn't inform their political program. They're not suggesting any administrative protocols, any laws, any forms of active anti-Semitic politics. In fact, in many ways, their political program is quite modern. They want the state to intervene, regulate the markets. They want some kind of price supports for agriculture. They talk about a graduated income tax. They talk about nationalizing the railroads. These are all rather prescient demands by the populace, even while they're talking about Shylock moneylenders and trading and other kinds of anti-Semitic rhetoric, because the stereotype of the Jewish Shylock gets attached to Wall Street very easily by these people, and it gives them a kind of historic way to vent their animosities.
Well, I thought it was interesting about that recurrent theme, really, is that it has a lot in common with classic anti-Semitism in the sense that the Jew becomes this repository of all the bad things about capitalism, the lack of national loyalty, the greed, the secrecy, the self-centeredness, the paranoia about the plotting and all. So in that sense, there is some common...
There absolutely is, in the sort of the cosmology, the kind of... the sense of conspiracy. Of course, conspiratorial thinking is shared by all sorts of people, both of the upper class and the lower class, about what's going on in America. But you're quite right about that. And in fact, it finds its, in my view, finished modern expression, or if not finished, more complete expression in the rantings of Henry Ford in the 1920s, who sees a gigantic global conspiracy of Jewish bankers and Jewish Bolsheviks who owe no loyalty to any nation, who only care about money-making and overturning the West, and who are engaged in a kind of gigantic Semitic conspiracy against hard-working Protestant America.
Now, if we look at the other end of the social spectrum, there is also, Jefferson, to some degree, was... rural aristocracy who looked down his nose at Wall Street, hated New York, had very nasty things to say about it. But we also had the Boston Brahmins who didn't like New York very much. The Adams brothers didn't like Wall Street.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the Adams brothers are a perfect case. You know, those who used to criticize the populace as kind of backward hayseeds who were subject to anti-Semitism because they were kind of ignorant rural hicks, forget that people like the Adams brothers and even Teddy Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge and all these Brahmin elitists also viewed this new power in the land, Wall Street, in anti-Semitic terms. And Henry Adams has some really fulsome, violent rhetoric directed against Morgan and the way Morgan and his allies among the Rothschilds and other Jewish, international Jewish bankers. For guys like Adams, commercial culture is Jewish culture. And the loss of America's descent into pure money-seeking, into a kind of greedy avariciousness, into a commercial ethos, is for people like Adams, both Brooks Adams and Henry Adams, proof of its Jewishness. And so they are quite violently anti-Semitic.
I'm speaking with Steve Fraser, author of Every Man a Speculator, History of Wall Street and American Life, just out from HarperCollins. The populace had their moment of crescendo and triumph in the 1890s, and they just kind of faded out to the American scene. What happened to them?
I don't know entirely. Obviously, after the great crash, the Great Depression of the 1890s, and there is an economic recovery of sorts, which does alleviate some of the enormous downward pressure on agricultural prices. So some of that is relief. Some of them are simply go extinct. They're wiped off the land. This is the part of a long story that continues on all through the 20th century. Remnants of them continue to exist in the nonpartisan league out in the Dakotas and the Great Plains, even in the period after World War I, where they're quite revolutionary-minded in their own way, and you see remnants of them again in the 1930s. But really, they're supplanted by a kind of urban form of protest, which is really what I think of as urban and small city protest, which is the progressive movement, which takes on Wall Street in different terms, sees Wall Street as a kind of great money trust that is blocking. If the populace wanted to restore an old kind of Jeffersonian democracy and a certain kind of smallholder agriculture, the progressives at the turn of the 20th century who supplant them really want in on modern capitalist economy. They want that kind of opportunity, and they feel that the Morgan dispensation is shutting them out, that this is a closed club, that you can't get in, that Morgan has Morgan and the group of investment banks around him favor certain industries, certain corporations. If you're not in that favored circle, you do not get lines of credit, you do not get underwritten if you want to go public. Moreover, they exercise enormous power over the political process, even despite occasional contentious relations with people like Teddy Roosevelt. And the progressives want to break this money trust. People like Louis Brandeis and so on want to break it open.
Let's step back to Morgan. Late 19th century, very rough economic times, a lot of ways, lots of panics, depressions, instability, and then Morgan takes all that wreckage and Morganizes it. Tell us about Morganization.
Yeah, Morganization is a fascinating process. You know, one of the things about my book is to sort of examine why, although Wall Street has been hated and reviled by many people, and maybe most people for the first 100, 150 years, other people liked it at various times and for different reasons. And one has to do with Morganization. The economy up till Morgan's time, say the mid-1890s, after that depression, is incredibly unstable. It's a very competitive economy, but it is enormously erratic. And beginning in 1819, you have a panic and depression pretty much every 15 years or so. And this is enormously worrying to all sorts of people, not only the victims, but all sorts of victims of that erraticism, including businesses and middle-class folk and so on. What Morgan does when he Morganizes the economy is he consolidates it. What we take for granted as the publicly traded big corporation is a Morgan invention, basically. Not just Morgan, but it's an invention of that era. And what it does...
It all happened very quickly, within less than a decade.
Very quickly, less than a decade. Maybe between 1897 and 1903, you have this vast merger movement take place in the economy, and all sorts of competitive corporations go out of business, are merged into much larger undertakings, the most famous of which is U.S. Steel, but there are many others, General Electric, International Harvester, and so on. And this brings a kind of stability to the economy. This kind of internecine, competitive, erratic instability is for a while not eliminated, but quiets down, and people look at Morgan as a great kind of imperial savior, a kind of rescuer from this much more dangerous form of economy. At least a certain fraction of the urban middle class and the new members of this new corporate management that comes into being find in Morgan a very impressive kind of figure for what he's done.
It's interesting. The populists, of course, didn't like Morgan very much, but some of the socialists at the time welcomed his restructuring.
Yes, that's a great point. The socialists see this Morgan consolidation of the economy as a kind of dress rehearsal, as a kind of antechamber to the general socialization of the whole economy, because what he's doing is bringing many, many enterprises under one umbrella, improving, presumably, the efficiency of these industries, massing together great numbers of industrial workers, creating actual organizational structures which, if they're taken out of private hands and become public, would become, in the eyes of the socialists, the basis for a new economy run in the public welfare. So actually, they kind of, when Morgan dies and everybody's eulogizing him in 1913, the socialist press says thank you, essentially. Thank you for, they hate him, of course, but they're tongue-in-cheek, they're saying thank you because you've done the work of consolidation which we, us socialists, will now use to take over this economy and run it in the public interest.
Morganization actually improved the reputation of Wall Street in America. It's sort of gentrification of Wall Street's image, in a sense. But that all came apart after the crash of 29. So what happened to Wall Street after 29?
Yeah, in my book, I call this the age of ignominy. And Wall Street, which had been the American ruling class, I mean, I think aside from the slavocracy, I think the closest thing we've ever had in America to a truly coherent ruling class is the one that existed under Morgan's reign from 1895 to 1929. The crash, in a political sense and in a cultural sense, not economically, destroys its reputation. It's not only blamed for the depression that follows, but all of its sense of omnipotence, its sense of its reputation as being wise, as being able to actually administer this vast economy, is destroyed. And it's politically attacked by the New Deal. It's made fun of. Wall Street suddenly emerges as not omnipotent, but as omni-incompetent. They got it all wrong, and they've produced this traumatic disaster, the second most serious trauma in the nation's history after the Civil War. For a long period of time, I would argue, from 1930, say, to almost 1980, Wall Street ceases to be a public political presence in our country's life, even though it clearly remains a power economically. It drops off the front page and recedes to the business page.
I was speaking with Steve Fraser, author of Every Man a Speculator, just out from HarperCollins. Let's fast forward a bit to the 80s when, well, the bull market took off in August 1982, and then Wall Street was really thrust into the center of American attention again in the 80s, and especially again in the 90s. So any of these past paradigms reborn in the last couple of decades?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think one of the interesting things to me about the 80s, though, most fascinating, is on the one hand, it's kind of like the 1890s. It's the second Gilded Age. And it continues into the 1990s, and all the kind of hero worshiping of these, you know, Wall Street warriors, their extravagant self-indulgence, their conspicuous consumption, their complete unconcern for the social world around them is very similar to what had happened 100 years earlier. On the other hand, what's very different is that guys like Milken and Boesky and the people of the 80s come on as rebels, as counter-revolutionaries disguised as revolutionaries. They're going to undo, they're going to free American industry and free American finance from government regulation and the ossified bureaucracies that presided over American industry and American finance. They're the rebels against the old white shoe Wall Street world. At least they portray themselves that way. They're going to make American industry lean and mean and have it compete with their Japanese and German rivals and so on. And for a while, they are hero worship for precisely that, even as they are denuding the country of its of the core of its American industry, even while they're engaged in the most outlandish junk bond speculations. Many people treat them as sort of heroes. And even after, look at, you know, Milken goes off to jail and a few other people do, and people still think of him as a, not everybody, there's Gordon Gekko after all. You know, there's Oliver Stone and Tom Wolfe in Bonfire of the Vanities making fun of these masters of the universe. But what's remarkable to me is, despite all their criminal behavior and the damage they did to the economy in the 80s and do again at the end of the 90s, what's so different from 100 years earlier is our reaction, is our country's reaction to that. These guys get away with murder and they don't pay the heavy political price of a progressive movement, of a populist movement, of a New Deal movement, which greeted their transgressions during the previous era. Instead, the response is rather tepid. You know, you get a Bonfire of the Vanities and you get a Wall Street movie and you get some books called, you know, Den of Thieves and Barbarians at the Gate. But what are the political consequences? Virtually none. Now we have Sarbanes-Oxley after this latest series of incredible scandals that make anything in the past seem benign by comparison. And Sarbanes-Oxley is the most timid form of regulatory response to this transgression. So to me, what that says is the culture has changed. And there is a kind of cultural support whose sources are various, and a lack of cultural opposition of the sort that Americans used to take for granted when it came to dealing with Wall Street.
It's interesting. You mentioned a series of books there, Bonfire of the Vanities, the movie Wall Street, but these are all 80s titles. Yeah. We didn't really see anything like that after the 90s, did we? Yeah,
very little you saw. There's a wonder, I don't know if you know it, there's a great book, I think hilariously funny, called Bombardiers by Poe Bronson, which is a hilarious send-up of these guys in the 90s, the way they're going to do IPOs for whole countries. You know, there are some, but you're right. They're even less. You have Maureen Dowd editorializing the New York Times, you know, that the 90s is the Gilded Age minus any moral censure that accompanied it in the 1880s. But you have less. Yeah, less and less.
Yeah, well, just in general, too, I mean, we look back at the 19th century, you had people like Herman Melville writing Bartleby the Scrivener. Right. Now we got Tom Wolfe. I guess he's our closest thing to Herman Melville. But yeah. Wall Street doesn't seem to have that central role in fiction or you know, literature that it did.
Well, right, or it's a different role. Like with Wolfe, what you get, see, Melville is excoriating. It's not just Bartleby the Scrivener. There's a wonderful novel he wrote called The Confidence Man, in which there's spectacular scenes on board the Mississippi riverboat that the book takes place on, about a Wall Street speculator. But the difference is, for Wolfe, it's all irony. We live in an age where there is nothing to do about this. Wolfe makes fun of these people, these masters of the universe, but everybody in Wolfe's world is corrupt. There is no moral or political vantage point from which to view them critically. It's very fatalistic, and that's the atmosphere which I think colors our own moment. I don't mean everybody is like that, but there's a kind of sense of this is the way the world is. And also accompanying that, for a large number of people, let's face it, Wall Street is a lot better than that. Wall Street is the place where they're going to make their millions. You know, in the 90s, you get this kind of, you know, shareholder nation attitude. It's been greatly exaggerated, but exaggerated. It has a real basis in some people's minds that, you know, the internet is going to, well, at least they believed it then. I don't know if anybody believes it now, but the internet was going to make Wall Street accessible to everybody, and you know, and everybody could be like Horace Greeley's Go West, Young Man. Now it was like Go Wall Street, Young Man, via the internet, and strike out on your own. And sort of that's, I guess, where the title of my book comes from, Every Man a Speculator. This has been a current in American culture for a long time, that in some sense, some Americans have always felt every man here is a speculator.
At what point you describe Wall Street as a bourgeois twilight zone, which I thought was a very nice phrase. And I can't remember the exact context you're applying that to, but it can really be quite broad. In many ways, it's, Wall Street has at one time, you know, wasps with inherited fortunes, self-made people with no fortunes at all. It's very turbulent. In many ways, it's open to just about anybody who can figure out how to play the game. It is revolutionary in a lot of ways, the way it overturns established hierarchies. At the same time, it can be very conservative. You know, you can, it's a very fuzzy thing to characterize precisely.
You've said it well, better than I could say it. I would only add one. You're right. There's been two Wall Streets. One is the one that we associated with Morgan. Orderly, prudential, control from the top, great institutions presiding over the whole economy, not even too crazy about the free market, doesn't like speculation. And then there's the other Wall Street, which is a much more erotic place where everybody's going to be gambling, audaciously striking.
Well, that's an interesting point, too. You talk a lot about how Wall Street, the imagery of Wall Street is very sexualized.
Yes, very, very sexualized. And you see this even beginning, say, with people like Vanderbilt the original Cornelius Vanderbilt, and Daniel Drew and Jim Fisk, who was a great womanizer in the age of the Civil War. And part of what their allure is, and people like this, is that they are irreverent and erotic. They're going to have their own way. They don't care what anybody says. They don't care what the rules of the game may be. They're in it to they're self-made men. They're Napoleonic, and they're going to operate on a great stage. And they are the quintessence of a certain kind of 19th century masculinity, of a new kind of highly sexualized masculinity, the conquistador, the master. And people are drawn, some people are drawn to Wall Street for that reason. And that kind of masculine mythos continues, you know, right down to liar's poker and the big swinging dick phenomenon of the 1880s. You know, who's the toughest wheeler and dealer on the Wall Street block? You know, who can make the others cringe?
Well, let's conclude in that disgraceful journalistic way of looking into the crystal ball. Is Wall Street going to continue to get the free pass it's gotten? I mean, they really made a mess of the economy in the late 90s. Very little political price to pay for that. Is this just a temporary period? Is this kind of a new model for America?
I think, but of course here we're all entitled to guess. I think the day of reckoning is coming, mainly not for some. I think people have shown an enormous capacity to put up with a lot of bullshit from Wall Street. I think that they're so undermining the economy that what is, I think, fairly inevitable is that there's going to be a real economic day of reckoning. I don't mean to say a Great Depression all over again, but perhaps something as severe or like that enough that people will be shaken out of their confidence in Wall Street and have to reckon with the damage that's been done.
And that was Stephen Fraser, author of the book Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life, just out from HarperCollins. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening, and let's go out with a bit more of Svetislav Richter playing Brahms' First Piano Sonata. Till next week. Bye.